Thing on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
From Hamilton, Ontario, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, microbes inside spiders reveal Canadian river pollution, and relentless Israeli genocide, apartheid, land theft, and forced expulsion of indigenous Bedouin communities. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. First, news headlines from GPM contributor Kylie Wong.
Street drugs laced with animal tranquilizers are sickening and killing people across British Columbia, health officials say. In January 2026, BC Emergency Health Sciences responded to 40 drug poisoning calls attributed to animal drugs, double the number Vancouver received during that time period. I spoke to one of the staff at the shelter, and they had a day last week where they had 11 people go down in one day, like within minutes of each other, Zach Killam, a peer support worker, said. Ottawa is providing $6 million towards a national research partnership aimed at improving Canada's economic productivity. The funding, provided by Social Sciences and Humanities Research of Canada, will be used across 15 years. It will include 30 researchers from 6 federal bodies, 6 universities, and 3 non-governmental organizations. University of Calgary economist Trevor Tome is directing the program. This partnership is about turning world-class research into practical insight for decision-makers on a national scale, Tome said in a news release. A new federal strategy aims to boost sales of electric vehicles, but skeptics aren't convinced. In early February, Prime Minister Mark Carney lifted Canada's electric vehicle mandate, reinstated purchase incentives, and announced that stricter fuel efficiency standards would be introduced. Ontario and Alberta premiers were pleased by the news. So is the Canadian automobile industry. Carney anticipates electric vehicles will account for 75% of new car sales by 2035, even without a mandatory sales requirement. But climate change experts say Carney's announcement doesn't go far enough. Rents across Canada are at their lowest in 31 months, easing pressure on prospective tenants. According to Rentals.ca and the latest report from a group called Urbanation, rents fell 2% year over year. Part of this decline is due to a decrease in unit size. The average size of a rental listings in January 2026 was 857 square feet, while the average last January was 885 and 943 2 years ago. If you're looking to get into the rental market, this is the best time we've seen in years, Giacomo Lattis, Associate Communications Director at Rentals.ca said. It really has gone back to the renter, which is a good thing. A new marine conservation area along Manitoba's Hudson Bay coast is under study. Manitoba Premier Wab Kinew has announced $250,000 in provincial funding towards a study for a new conservation area. There currently are 5 national marine conservation areas in Canada, 1 in Nunavut, 1 in British Columbia, 1 in Quebec, and 1 in the Lake Superior and Lake Huron region. At the highest level, you have a commitment from our government that we want to protect the waters in the area as we pursue commercial development, Premier Kinew said at a news conference. And that's news, David.
Thanks, Kylie.
You're welcome, David.
Anyone who's flown across Canada coast to coast knows the country is covered in lakes and rivers. Pristine waters where fish and aquatic invertebrates abound, right? Think again. Like everywhere else on planet Earth, even the most remote spots, those waters are polluted to a greater or lesser extent. Industrial effluents are the major source, right? Think again, again. Of all the pollutants entering Canadian surface waters, most come from people's sinks and toilet bowls and from storm waters flowing down urban streets. Municipal treatment plants do their best to remove organic pollutants. Others remain. Personal care products, detergents, partially metabolized drugs, hand sanitizing compounds, and vast quantities of microplastics with toxic compounds embedded in them flow into Canadian waters around the clock. Then there are PFASs, those forever chemicals, and toxins like mercury in the remotest locations. Karen Kidd has spent her career studying the effects toxic contaminants have on creatures living in Canadian lakes and rivers and inhabiting their wooded shores. Among these, riparian spiders. Those arachnids dine on insects emerging from surface waters. The contaminants inside those insects seem to alter the communities of microbes living inside of the spiders. Dr. Karen Kidd is a professor in the Department of Biology at McMaster University. The GPM paid a visit to the Kidd lab to learn more about how spider microbiomes are being used to monitor river pollution. Tell me who you are and where you are and what you do, and just a little bit about your research. Introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Karen Kidd. I'm a professor in the biology department at McMaster University, and I'm an ecotoxicologist.
In Hamilton, Ontario.
In Hamilton, yes, the Hammer. And as an ecotoxicologist, I've spent my career looking at the fate and effects of contaminants in aquatic systems. And so I've had the pleasure of being at McMaster since 2017 and working with a fantastic group of graduate students, undergraduates, and postdocs like Milena and Colleen that are here in the room with us.
It's interesting that the largest, by volume, the largest discharge of effluent in Canada, because you're studying the impact of substances that are in effluent that are going into surface waters, lakes, and rivers, aquatic ecosystems, and the largest volume of discharge going into surface waters is coming from municipal outflows.
You're right, yes.
Which isn't all that surprising when you think about it, but talk about this, because people might not realize that of all the polluted water going into our surface waters, there's more coming in from cities that the people are pouring down the drain than from anywhere else.
Right, so whatever we're flushing down the drain, down the toilet, using on a daily basis is going into our sewer systems, hopefully going to a wastewater treatment plant where it's being treated to remove organics and before it's discharged into our surface waters, but collectively across the country, that's the largest source of effluents to our rivers and lakes. And all of those waters from industries, from households, contains a lot of different types of chemicals. Hundreds of thousands of chemicals are in our products, in our industrial applications, and ultimately those chemicals are getting into our rivers and lakes because they're not being efficiently broken down in the wastewater treatment process.
And so that's very, very difficult to actually do that.
It's difficult. Well, the plants themselves aren't designed to treat these chemicals. They're designed to remove noxious substances like ammonia or oxygen-demanding substances. That's what's legislated under the Federal Wastewater Systems Effluent Regulations. And luckily for us, some of the processes that treat those compounds can reduce some of the chemicals that we're concerned about as ecotoxicologists, like microplastics, like pharmaceuticals, some pesticides.
Personal care products.
Personal care products, yes. So there's a lot of different types of chemicals that are entering our rivers and lakes, getting taken up into fish, aquatic insects, and ultimately having impacts on their ability to grow, reproduce, and survive.
Can you be a little bit more specific about what are the components, the chemical components that are going down drains and being flushed down toilets and entering surface waters, like pharmaceuticals, for example? What sorts of pharmaceuticals?
Well, whatever we're using. There's thousands of different active pharmaceutical ingredients that Canadians take on a daily basis, from prescription drugs to over-the-counter medications, you know, to treat pain, anti-anxiety, antidepressants, anti-cancer agents.
Estrogenic compounds,
that are used in birth control. Yes. So there's a lot of hormone-active compounds you know, whatever we're using to improve our health, to treat disease, to prolong our lives, is ultimately ending up in our fresh waters. And because those compounds are designed to be active, biologically active, and because vertebrates in general share a lot of common biological processes, our physiology is not that much different from the physiology of a fish. So when we use hormones to control our reproduction, they can actually have pretty serious consequences for fish reproduction as well. So one of the water quality issues I've been studying for a long time is the presence of estrogens in surface waters. So when women take the birth control pill, for example, they're excreting the estrogen, and then that's getting taken up by male fish and resulting in those fish becoming feminized. And a feminized fish, feminized male fish, doesn't reproduce as well. And so sometimes that leads to declines in fish populations. So that's one example of something that's, you know, that we are using as humans that has a lot of benefit for us, but that has a lot of negative negative outcomes for the wildlife, the fish and other life in our rivers.
And detergents, quaternary ammonium compounds you've been studying.
Yes, and that one I'm going to turn over to Milena because she's heavily involved in our whole lake experiment about quats. So she could explain.
Let's hold off on that for a second. Let's come back to you, Milena, because I want to talk about the experimental lake.
Okay, good.
Which is fascinating. But tell me about the spiders.
So we've been working on spiders for about the last 10 years. And one of the great things about them is that there are many living along the rivers. A lot of them feed off of aquatic insects that emerge from the rivers. And what we know is that those insects that are emerging and getting eaten by the spiders are carrying with them a lot of these chemicals that go into rivers from wastewater treatment plants. So they're accumulating microplastics, which Colleen is working on. They're accumulating pharmaceuticals, other household chemicals in their tissues, and then bringing that with them as they come out of the water. Those spiders are feeding on the aquatic insects.
And what kinds of spiders?
Well, there's all sorts of kinds, but we tend to work on ones that are called tetranathids, orb-weaving spiders. And they're easy to catch. We go out at night with headlamps on. They build their webs along the shore of the river, and then we just pick them off their webs. Colleen's an expert at that. She can tell you how much fun that is. Bring them back to the lab and look at either the levels of chemicals in their bodies or how those chemicals are affecting the bacteria that live on the spiders. And that's something that Milena's been working on a lot too, is the microbiome, or that the host bacteria that live, or the bacterial communities that live on the host, the spiders themselves. So the spiders, depending on where you find them, they can be quite high in some metals, some pharmaceuticals, because they're getting it from their diet, and their diet is mainly aquatic insects.
And how does that affect them?
Well, that's something we don't know a lot about yet. It does seem to change the types of bacteria that are on them. We think that in turn could influence their ability to reproduce, some of their behaviors, but that's the next step. So now that we know they're getting exposed to these drugs, that their microbiomes are changing, we want to start looking more at what it means for spider populations.
And spiders have a microbiome.
They do, just like you and I. They have a microbiome.
People talk about the human microbiome.
Yes.
There are more bacteria, more prokaryotes in us and on us than there are cells of our own.
Yes,
supposedly.
It's amazing.
It's amazing, but which we depend on for our health. But spiders, well, I mean, all animals have their own microbiomes, don't they? And spiders have their own microbiome.
They do. And you think about how important microbiomes are for humans and what we know about how influential our gut microbiome is, for example, for our mental health. This field in ecotoxicology of linking contaminant exposure to an organism's microbiome is really in its infancy. That's something that's just been looked at maybe the last, 5 years or so, I guess. So what we're doing is really cutting edge, pioneering the use of microbiomes as an early warning for contaminant effects.
Milena, tell me who you are.
Yeah, hi, my name is Milena. I'm a postdoc in Karen Kidd's lab here at McMaster, and I'm particularly interested in microbial communities and how they are affected in our environments due to anthropogenic stressors.
And where do you go out in the field and do your capture your spiders?
So there are basically right now two main areas where I'm working on. So one is the experimental lakes area, where we do a whole lake experiment on quaternaria ammonium compounds. But I'm also going out here in the Grand River and study the microbiomes of insects and spiders that are affected by wastewater effluents.
Tell me about the Grand River. Where is the Grand River? Southwestern Ontario.
Yeah, it's very big.
Flows through like London and...
Yeah, through a lot of big cities. I know, I think Guelph.
Kitchener. All the way down to like Erie.
Yeah, All the way down, yeah.
So you wander around the shores, the banks of the Grand River at night with a headlamp on and you capture spiders.
Yes, and then during the day we capture all the insects too, the insect larvae that we find there. So the idea is that we look at the insect larvae that live in the river. They come out at night and emerge as flying insects, and these get caught by spiders. And that's what we look at, yes.
And so you catch your spiders, and what do you do with them? You bring them back to the lab?
We bring them back to the lab, and they get extracted for the DNA, and we use the DNA to identify the microbiome of them, so the specific markers that tell us which bacteria are inside these organisms.
Is that ribosomal RNA?
Yes, it's ribosomal RNA, exactly. So we target the 16S rRNA gene to assess bacterial communities in them.
Huh. And what are your controls? What are you comparing these sequences with in terms of unexposed?
Yeah, we do have multiple sites. So in the Grand River, the data set that I'm working on is specifically looking at Brantford up and downstream and Waterloo. So we look right before the effluent enters the Grand River and right after that and compare how they change due to the effluent exposure.
And this is municipal effluent?
Yes.
So this is stuff that people are pouring down their sink and flushing down their toilet?
Yes.
Have you been doing this long enough to come up with results? Are you starting to see interesting shifts in the microbiome of these spiders?
So yeah, we do have an older data set that has been done by a previous postdoc, Dr. Brittany Perota. She has generated some data, and we're working on the data analysis. It's looking at 4 different wastewater treatment plants along the Grand River. And what we see is that the microbial communities are changing, both in the insects but also in the spiders, if we go from upstream to downstream on all of these wastewater effluent, wastewater treatment plants.
How are they changing?
So they're...
I mean, microbiology is fascinating.
Yes, it is very complex. These communities are quite big. In terms of spiders, what we see is that the community is changing, so we do have some bacteria that appear downstream that are particularly associated with detoxification mechanisms. But more interestingly, in terms of spiders, are the decrease in endosymbionts. So these are key bacteria for spiders that are very strongly linked to the host itself. So
these are bacteria that live inside the spider cells.
In and on the spiders themselves, yes.
So you call them endosymbionts.
Endosymbionts, because they are basically, these bacteria are dependent on the host itself. They don't live in the environment on its own. So that's why they have a really strong connection with the host, so the spider.
And so these endosymbionts, these are normally present.
Yes.
And
yes.
What you're saying is that these shifts in the microbiome of the spiders is bringing in others that are not endosymbionts.
Yeah, they do have associations with other bacteria. So the microbiome in general is very variable, so not every individual has the same microbiome. But specifically these, as I mentioned, they're dependent on the host itself. So for instance, a Wolbachia, you would find...
Wolbachia.
Yeah, that's one type of bacterium. You wouldn't find that in the environment living on its own. It's really dependent on spiders, but it's also living in other insects as well. Mm-hmm. The Wolbachia, it mainly lives in the ovaries of spiders. So it's very interested in getting basically transferred to new spiders. So it changes how the sex ratio in spiders is, because it lives in the ovaries, it wants to have more female spiders, and that's why it's affecting the host to produce more female
offspring.
Yeah.
So the Wolbachia, its natural internal habitat is the ovaries,
yes,
of female spiders, and so it's actually driving the proliferation or the increased contribution of female spiders to the population?
Exactly, yes. Huh. And it's like a natural, similar to parasites, they're not just bad, it's like a natural relationship. And if we lose these, obviously the dynamics change in these populations. And the question is, what is the outcome for these organisms?
And are you counting spiders, like on these various spots, kind of monitoring the size of the spider population?
No, not really.
It's pretty tough.
It is, yeah. They're quite difficult. Like, we would love to do maybe some lab experiments, but it's not very easy to keep them in the lab and get them to reproduce so far.
Huh. So you were working at the Experimental Lakes area.
Yes.
Let's talk about that. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Colleen. I'm a PhD candidate in Dr. Karen Kidd's lab at McMaster University in Hamilton.
And what's your PhD research on?
So I'm focused on biology. Particularly, I'm looking at microplastics in aquatic food webs.
Huh. We've heard a lot about microplastics.
Yes, absolutely.
And where are you doing this and what are you finding?
So I work in the Grand River watershed in southern Ontario, which Milena mentioned, through Kitchener and Waterloo all the way down to Caledonia for my sites. And what we are looking at is wastewater treatment facilities as a potential source of microplastics to the river through their effluent. So what we look at is...
And there's tons and tons of microplastics in wastewater effluent.
Yes, so the wastewater does its job. It does remove a really high proportion of particles from what it's receiving from the municipalities. So it could remove something like 70 to 99% of the microplastic particles. But the issue is that 1% with wastewater treatment facilities treating hundreds of liters of water every day, it can still equate to millions of microplastics entering the river through the effluent.
How big are these particles?
So with microplastics, they tend to focus on microplastics are particles 5 millimeters or less. Some definitions go down to 1 micrometer. So it's a very big range between visible that you can see and invisible.
But the nanoplastics, these are much smaller.
Very tiny.
Very tiny. So what impact are you hypothesizing these microplastics are having on? So you're looking at aquatic food webs. You're looking at the fish and at the invertebrates and at the spiders as well, and crushing these things up and measuring microplastics.
So what we're focused on with the aquatic food webs is we're looking at effluent, and if the microplastic particles from the effluent are settling into basal resources like the sediment and biofilms that aquatic insects live in and feed on. We then are looking at the larval form of the aquatic insects, and particularly ones that are emergent insects, so ones that have that aquatic life stage, and then also metamorphosize and become terrestrial. So we're looking at the movement of microplastics from the aquatic food webs into the terrestrial. And of course, spiders are the predators in that food web that are feeding on the emergent insects.
And so you're measuring microplastics in spiders?
Yes.
in measurable quantities?
The quantities are...
I mean, if you took spiders that were, you know, upstream of a major outflow, you know, upstream of Guelph, and then you look at spiders downstream from Guelph, would you see a noticeable difference in the quantity of microplastics?
So we looked at 8 wastewater treatment facilities, and it seems that there's some facilities that do indicate higher levels downstream, and others that there's no significant noticeable difference between the levels in spiders up and downstream.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's not consistently higher downstream.
I have an idea about that. So what's really fascinating about Colleen's project is that this is a full circle story. So a lot of plastics, yes, they do come out of wastewater treatment plants because of all of the plastic materials, all of our plastic clothing that we're washing is shedding so many plastic fibers. And certainly that's a point source of microplastics to the rivers. But there's also so many non-point sources. And what I mean by that is stormwater inputs. Agriculture uses a lot of plastic. So there's so many sources of plastics to our rivers that when we look at fish guts or we look at insects living in the rivers or the spiders along the shore, we see microplastics everywhere. Like, it's just one of those contaminants. Because we use so many plastics, we don't dispose of them properly. Very few are recycled. You know, the single-use plastics are so common these days that it's just we're putting a lot of plastic into our rivers.
And it's in the air. It's in dry fall.
It is. It's in our air. It's in our rainfall. Yes. So Colleen's research is really important because it's helping us understand the risks of wastewater treatment plants as a source of microplastics to our rivers. Do we need to improve the treatment of these effluents, or should we focus on other sources of microplastics to the river? And in some of the sites she's working on, there are as many microplastics upstream as there are downstream. So to us, that's saying we really need to focus on the bigger picture and figure out which sources of microplastics are the biggest ones. And Colleen could talk about what these plastics do when they get into organisms, too. That's not part of her project, but there's a lot of toxicity work that's going on in our group and as well at the University of Guelph that's showing that they can have harm to the organisms that ingest them.
Because, of course, these microplastics, they're composed of, petroleum products that are toxic and softeners and phthalates and heaven knows what else. But, I mean, these plastics, they also absorb toxins from the environment.
Yes.
They're kind of sponges for things that are floating around in the water.
So microplastics, there are just numerous issues connected with them. From their high mobility, because they're so teeny tiny that they can be picked up in the wind, they can be swept away in the water, they can be inhaled. So they're very, very mobile. Even if the plastics are starting out around here, they've even been detected on the tops of mountains, they've been detected in Arctic, the deepest parts of the ocean, so they just find their way everywhere. In terms of toxicity, that's also a major question. There can be physical harms from ingesting plastic, from gut blockages to food dilution. So if the organism accidentally ingests plastic thinking it's food, they're not getting that normal nutritional benefit from their regular food source.
And of course, they're tiny. I mean, when we're talking about insects,
yes,
they're very small, and so the passageways, they're pretty narrow.
Yes.
And so what's pretty trivial for a human being, although not necessarily microplastic, it's like swallowing a huge chunk of something.
Yes, it can be. For something like a zooplankton, getting tangled up in like a microfiber that comes from our clothing could be very difficult for it to be mobile after that interaction. There's also the chemical concerns with microplastics, that they're made of tons of different little chemicals. So the additives like plasticizers, dyes, antimicrobials, fire retardants, those do have potential to leave the plastic and enter the ecosystem. And then on the flip side, the plastic also is capable of absorbing contaminants from the ecosystem. So things like heavy metals or PCBs might attach itself to that plastic.